humans, animals, inanimate objects, welcome to the OneLiner.com podcast. It's been a long time. He shouldn't have left you without a dope film podcast to step to. I am Scott Morris. Joining me today is Drew Tavendale.
Hello.
Yeah, been a while away, mainly my fault, I'm afraid, with annoying personal stuff and relocating and all sorts of stuff going on. So that does mean, although we've not watched quite as many films lately, we still have a bit of a backlog because we've not done anything since January. So we're going to catch up on a shitload of films, very briefly, for most of them, because yes. Our memories are failing because we are old, old men. To start things off on this quickfire round, we're going to talk about The Railway Man. Drew, what's that all about?
Yes, The Railway Man, based on a true story. It's a former British Army officer. And when he starts a relationship with his wife soon discovers that he is suffering night terrors and other sorts of forms of what nowadays would be recognised as post-traumatic stress disorder. She looks into his history, which he's very reluctant to talk about, encourages him to go back to Burma and confront the man who tortured him while he was a prisoner of war in a Japanese prisoner of war camp and forced to work on the Burma Railroad. Yeah, I feel like we're saying this a lot tonight. It's all right. Colin Firth, having moved on from his days of being the poor man's Hugh Grant,
yeah.
Nowadays pretty accomplished actor. In this, he's pretty accomplished. Nicole Kidman's a bit of a cold fish in this as his wife. Not given a lot to do in her defence, but she's not the most engaging character. It's one of those films that I think, because of the topic that it covers, people seem to think that it's really worthy. It's not that great.
Right.
Interesting period. Like, most people would know it most famously through The Bridge and the River Kwai. It's the same railroad. It covers some of the torture that it goes through. It's pretty horrific. It's kind of interesting for the period, but it's just, as a film, it's no great shakes. It's all a bit too muted. Albeit that all there's torture in it and things, it's fairly drab. And if you're a fan of Colin Firth, probably worth checking out. Again, I wouldn't like to think it's a bad film. It's just, it's unremarkable.
More of a damp squid than a slow burn.
It's, yeah, it's okay.
It's certainly a film. And next up, Jack Ryan, Shadow Recruit. Another Tom Clancy affair, in this case, something of a reboot for the series, which sees Captain Kirk become the young CIA analyst, Chris Pine, stepping into the Jack Ryan role. This sees him just leaving college. He's recruited into the CIA after the 9/11 in this new timeline, I suppose, that it's got. He works undercover in the financial areas, which leads him to uncover some suspicious money patterns, which eventually tracks back to some Russian outfit. It turns out that the Russians are planning something nefarious on American soil, and despite being just a intelligence analyst, he's forced to go out into the field under the tutelage of Kevin Costner. And this also involves his wife in some fashion, just to give us a little bit of added peril to spice things up. It's kind of a standard-ish spy affair. I probably enjoyed this a bit more than the standard opinion would be. I thought it actually worked quite well. I like Chris Pine. I thought Kevin Costner does pretty well in it. My only real complaint is that Kenneth Branagh's directing, and well, he's very good at directing. If you did need to get a Russian villain, why not get a Russian person rather than Kenneth Branagh doing accent like this, which is a little bit crap.
Yes, precisely. This is my sole issue with it too, Scott. I would say it's a above competent thriller. Chris yes. Pine acquits himself well. He certainly stopped himself being boxed in as being Captain Kirk from Star yes. Trek. And yeah, it's a decent thriller. Keira Knightley, she's okay, I guess, but not given a massive amount to do.
Mm-hmm.
Quite entertaining, decent production values. Kevin Costner's very watchable, but again, yeah, it's Kenneth Branagh.
Yeah, with just that accent, man.
Terrible accent. It's unnecessary.
Yeah. I shouldn't really harp on about it because everything else is done really pretty well. Certainly, I'd say a good bit above average, but it's just that annoying little thing that keeps dragging it down a little bit. It didn't need to be there. So, but regardless of that, I still would recommend having a look at it, especially if you've got any interest in the kind of spy genre.
It's got to, as it starts off, something that I assume is from the books, but if you only know them from the films as I do, if you know The Hunt for Red October, when he travels to the aircraft carrier in the North Atlantic, and it's mentioned that he was in a helicopter crash in the Mediterranean and spent a year and a half learning to walk again and did his final year of his course from the hospital.
Mm.
That's how this film starts off. It's transported from the Mediterranean to Afghanistan, I think.
Yeah.
But it just touches that, which just sort of ties it in nicely. While it's another reboot of the character and the time is shifted, it ties it in nicely with stuff that's already been mentioned. Next, Grudge Match, a film I remember exceptionally well. This is something that feels a little bit like Rocky Balboa, which is makes some sense given that Sylvester Stallone stars in it. And it features him being a retired boxer coaxed back into one final showpiece fight. The twist here, though, is that there's another aging actor who's his opponent in this, and that's Robert De Niro. The two have a shared enmity, and there's always been dispute between them about quite who won the final bout and who was the best between them. I say it's a bit like Rocky Balboa, it's nothing like as successful as that was. And just to mystify you as much as I've left myself mystified, the only note I made about it at the time was a quote, I think. Putting your thing where it doesn't belong. This is white people shit, man. There we go. I'm quite tempted to leave it on that.
Our opinion, blamange out of 10.
I mean, it's got a couple upsides. It's got the ever-watchable Alan Arkin in basically the Burgess Meredith role as the trainer. It's got support from Kim Basinger. It's just, it's no great shakes, unfortunately. Kevin Hart plays the promoter in it, and he's just sort of a comic character that doesn't quite fit in with the rest of the tone of the film. Yeah, it's a bit rubbish.
Right, I'll move on. Under the Skin, which is the worst film I've seen this year, and will, I'm sure, remain so. It had promise. I mean, it's set in Scotland, and we have a certain tendency to at least give Scottish films a bit of a break, because, you know, Scotland, I'm Scottish, what are you going to do? But this is just dreadful. A horrible piece of experimental filmmaking that involves Scarlett Johansson as some form of synthetic alien-type creature who obviously looks like Scarlett Johansson, but is spending her time trolling around Glasgow, inviting young men to get into her creepy van with the goal of taking them back to her home, and not so much showing them as a good time as, well, it seems to be just making them walk into a pool of water, at which point they get dissolved somehow. It's all a bit conceptual. It has a lot of things going on with it, like I think it was a 3-minute establishing shot where it's just zooming very slowly into an eyeball, if memory serves. It is highly experimental in a way that's supposed to have a kind of hypnotic feel to it, but it's actually just really boring. It feels really pretentious. Nothing much of any interest happened. There is some interesting things about the way it's produced. You know, they were hiding hidden cameras in this van, and so a lot of the people that you actually see that are driving around didn't really know they were going to be on a film. It was just sort of filmed slightly guerrilla style around Govan. There's a lot of things that I think I would have liked, or I like as a sort of general concept for filmmaking, but just none of it's really panned out, and basically it's just excruciatingly boring, and it seems to last for about 17 days. No, not one for me. Maybe if you're suitably stoned, you'd be able to get something out of this, but you know, for people with functioning critical capacity, I don't think there's anything to like in Under the Skin. Avoid. I didn't like it. Did that come across? No?
You maybe want to expound on that a little, Scott.
Yeah, I give this film 73%.
Next, Out of the Furnace, starring Christian Bale and Casey Affleck. Christian Bale's a factory worker, and his brother, played by Casey Affleck, is a former Marine. When Christian Bale's character Russell is imprisoned for killing somebody while driving drunk, his brother Rodney kind of goes off the rails and begins to indulge in the underground bare-knuckle boxing scene. Well, I say indulge. Take part in. It's not quite enjoyable enough to be called indulging, I don't think. But when he comes out of prison, Russell sees that this has happened to his brother and tries to put him back in the straight and narrow, more or less, and tries to put his life back together. Rodney, however, is having none of it, and he also suffering from PTSD and doesn't quite know what to do with himself now he's out of the army and in the way of these things has rather been left hanging by the people who should be supporting him, i.e. the government. Rodney, having got himself into financial trouble, begs the man who normally arranges his fights to get him involved in a much higher paying but far riskier fight in the hillbilly country of New Jersey, run by a rather terrifying and psychopathic Woody Harrelson. Things don't exactly go according to plan there, and when Rodney doesn't return, Russell starts taking the law into his own hands and looking for him. This is a real disappointment, this film, actually. So it's got a pleasing low-key aesthetic. It's got a cracking cast. It's got Casey Affleck, Christian Bale, directed by the guy that directed the quite entertaining Crazy Heart. It's got Zoe Saldana, Willem Dafoe, Woody Harrelson, who's rather scary in this, pulls it off well. Sam Shepard, Forest Whitaker. Very much less than some of its parts, though. The characters really aren't very compelling. The story stumbles in the middle and doesn't make a huge amount of sense. For instance, you have a criminal who goes to the bother of disposing of one body so no one will find it, but this was while the person who was in a car next to him, they just shot in the middle of the road and left. that sort of thing kind of threw me. It's just a bit of a disappointment. There's not enough of a compelling story in there, and I certainly wouldn't recommend anybody check it out.
Right, let's crash on. Spike Jonze's still latest film, I suppose, but Her, which has been out for a while. One of the more critically acclaimed films that we'll talk about, but one that I didn't actually rate all that highly. Set in the not-too-distant future, although it is a point where computer operating systems have now become so advanced that they can mimic human behaviour and human speech patterns and all that kind of stuff to a perfect degree, to the point where you can now just talk to your computer as though it's a real person. This causes some issues for Joaquin Phoenix as he buys a new operating system and promptly starts to fall in love with it. Just by the pure tone of her voice, the operating system played by Scarlett Johansson. There's not really anything bad in Her. It's a perfectly fine story. I just don't think that it's anything like as interesting as it was cracked up to be, because all the reviews talked about how interesting this concept was of, you know, maybe falling in love with computers or something, but the very way they framed it removed all that for me, because the essential premise in this is that the computer operating system that he's talking to is indistinguishable from a human being. And at that point, it's really just like any number of long distance relationships you can imagine. Just the person on the other end of the line doesn't have a body at the end of it. So it winds up just being a love story between two humans, which is somewhat less remarkable than it was cracked up to be. It only really becomes a plot point that the other person is a computer at the end of the film, where she essentially goes off to join her home planet, and in a way that brings up the computer angle a bit more. But up until really the last 10 to 15 minutes of the film, it's just a standard love story about a long-distance relationship. Perfectly decent one. Joaquin does quite well. Scarlett Johansson does a pretty decent job in it as well. It's well shot. Despite all of that, still relatively interesting. A film I did enjoy well enough, but certainly nothing like as much as other people have cracked it up to be.
No, people seem to go rather head over heels for this, and I don't quite see what the hook is here. Your point about it being like a long-distance relationship is quite spot on. Also, it's got that weird world that's quite common, but that weird futuristic thing in a lot of indie sci-fi where the world is weirdly empty and sterile.
Yeah, yeah.
And it makes it really, really hard to engage with the world because it's so cold and it's therefore off-putting. So while you can get into the characters a bit, everywhere they live is so sterile. Again, very probably a deliberate choice, but just a poor one, I think, because everything's so cold and there's nothing to get help draw you into the film because it's not a place you want to be.
Yeah.
Joaquin Phoenix, despite the really weird choice of facial hair and the plethora of very high-waisted trousers, quits himself well. Weirdly dowdy-looking Amy Adams, actually underused.
Yeah.
I think the fact that he had this other woman, who's not a love interest as such, but just that, like, this other woman who's having a similar relationship with her computer, I think the fact that she was in such close proximity having a similar thing, that maybe been played more, it'd be more interesting if they'd had these two people talking about it more when they're actually real humans and seeing whether that caused any tension with their relationship with the, well, effectively absent partner.
Mm-hmm.
Seed of an interesting idea in there. I just don't think it was developed well enough. There wasn't enough about a computer. It was just, it was somebody on the end of a phone line.
Yeah, it's like they minimised all that stuff to try and make it a bit more accessible, which they've done, and I suppose it is, but it makes it a much less interesting film.
Yep.
Gojira!
Yes, Gojira next, or Godzilla to our silly Westerners. It's Godzilla. What do I say about it? It's streets ahead of Pacific Rim. There's point number one.
Mm-hmm.
Mystical sightings of this giant beast for ages that's been causing earthquakes. Nobody knows what it is. Breaking Bad's Bryan Cranston is a scientist at a nuclear power plant in Japan, which suffers a catastrophic meltdown in which his wife is killed. And he just basically never buys the official explanation for what caused it. He spends the next 50 years of his life looking for the signal, the seismic signals that he saw before it, which eventually leads to the discovery of not Godzilla, but a giant cockroach, which Raid is just not going to take care of. This giant cockroach is of an ancient species that feeds on radioactive material, and it starts trashing the planet while trying to get its teeth into all the world's nuclear missiles and other fissible material. Humans try to stop it and can basically do nothing, and we're all going to die. But then, magically, Godzilla appears. and saves the day because he's Godzilla. I don't think that's giving it away. You know how this is going to go. The hook is that it's Godzilla, and I feel that they missed the point a bit here. There's not really enough Godzilla.
Yeah.
I understand why they've chosen to be quite sparing with it, at least in the early stages. It's a mysterious creature. You're seeing glimpses of it, and you see far more than you'd see in something like Cloverfield, where the monster wasn't really the point. When it worked for Cloverfield, it was the unknown threat. The appeal of Godzilla, again, Godzilla. It's a giant, stompy monster that you want to see being giant and stompy. Stomping around on everything as a giant, you know, because that's why you watch a giant, stompy monster movie.
Yeah.
It focuses far too much on the humans, and in this film, they're just not interesting.
Yeah, it's the sort of film that shouldn't have been called Godzilla, it should have been called That Guy Out of Kick-Ass, isn't it?
Yes, yeah, it doesn't help that Aaron Johnson's in it. He's perhaps not quite as charisma-free in this as he often is.
Yeah, but, yeah.
But, and again, this time, possibly not his fault, because nobody human comes out of this particularly well.
No.
I mean, it's still pretty entertaining, I just want more Godzilla. It focuses too much on the story between Bryan Cranston and Aaron Johnson, and then Aaron Johnson and his wife and kid, and all the damage that's been done to humans, and I don't care.
Yeah.
And I don't think most of the audience care. It's a big monster movie. More big monsters, please. This is not a case of, you want to use it sparingly, I want to see Godzilla.
It's just a film that has too little of the title character in it. It's not really about Godzilla. It turns out to be about largely wandering around with Aaron Johnston as he gets into these scrapes, and he's not that interesting. The big monsters are, but you don't see enough of them. Yeah, it's just not particularly exciting in any real way. It's not the worst film ever, but it's just a bit bland. I've seen worse creature features. It does have a little bit more heart and soul to it, but not enough to really make it worth recommending. Pretty mediocre stuff.
It's underwhelming and misses the point. This is the problem.
Yeah. Jersey Boys, then. Not what you would immediately associate with Clint Eastwood wanting to direct, but this is the story of four young chaps from New Jersey who joined together to become the Four Seasons, headed, of course, by Frankie Valli. And it is an adaptation of the Broadway production, and it's relatively faithful to that, because as far as I can tell, certainly it's by no means a straight biopic. There's plenty of musical moments in there, but not so much that you could really call it a complete musical. It's sort of halfway between a biopic and a musical. There's still a fair amount of Frankie Valli turning and talking to the camera to exposition his way through a couple of scenes. It's perfectly acceptable. I had no real interest in seeing anything about Four Seasons or Frankie Valli. I'm not a huge fan or anything like that, but we happened to stumble into the cinema to watch it, and it was perfectly entertaining for the 2 hours or so that it's there. Not really a great deal more to say about it. I think you'll get a fair amount out of it if you enjoy Frankie Valli's music, and to be fair, Frankie Valli's not someone who would be most people's favourite artist, but there's not probably too many people who can't stand him either. So it's got a fairly broad audience, I would imagine. It's perfectly acceptable. It's well shot. The actors do a pretty decent job of maintaining interest. It sounds quite good. It's got Christopher Walken in it. What more can you ask for? It's perfectly acceptable entertainment, although obviously if you can't stand Frankie Valli's music, you probably won't get a lot out of it. That's my only real cautionary tale. Other than that, it's pretty decent. If you've got any interest in that kind of thing, give it a look.
The Amazing Spider-Man 2, which is a sequel to The Amazing Spider-Man and isn't really all that amazing. Do I need to explain the plot of a Spider-Man film? Probably not. Spider-Man has to battle some villains, protect the woman he loves, and he does this to varying degrees of success. This film carries on some of the mysterious disappearances of his mother and father from the first film, and their new take on Spider-Man's backstory, and it's kind of hard to care. It's simply not very interesting. The backstory that he had before seemed entirely adequate to me. Seem to just have to add extra drama in here, give him extra reasons to attack people that weren't really necessary. Two things I think really worth talking about in this, though, are the villains, because they're a bit disappointing, really.
Yeah.
Largely because they seem to lack motivation. I mean, the most interesting, most successful two would be Jamie Foxx's Electro, who begins life as an electrician, a technician, working at Oscorp, that is largely an invisible person. He's quite a sad and sympathetic character, and nobody seems to notice him, but expects him to fix things, and rather than standing up for himself, he grumbles but does it. While fixing an electrical conduit on late night, he has a terrible accident and is mutated into a being of pure electricity in the way of such things. there's something interesting there. The idea of this man being able to control electricity makes for quite an interesting potential foe for Spider-Man. He's a fairly sympathetic character to begin with, and really turns into a villain because in the middle of a public event, he feels that he's been upstaged by Spider-Man, somebody who he thought was a friend before, and he's upset that Spider-Man doesn't remember him. And for somebody who has felt ignored all his life and that Spider-Man was the one person who'd ever really paid any attention to him, I get that this character would get a bit annoyed with that and he's gone a bit mad with his powers. Okay. The biggest problem with this film, though, and what makes it so disappointing, not really because I wasn't expecting much from it, but underwhelming, is Dane DeHaan's Harry Osborn. He comes back from a long time away at boarding school to find that his father's dying and that he has to take over Oscorp. Okay, that this seems all straightforward so far. He's Peter Parker's friend of old. They start their friendship up again. That's all good. And then suddenly this character goes from this young man who gets told he has a debilitating disease, but probably has a good 30 years at least before it affects him, is suddenly dying and has turned into an evil maniac within about 2.5 days.
Yeah.
Which is my big issue with the film. There are interesting ideas in here as to why somebody would become a villain. In this case, it starts off with Norman Osborn, then Harry Osborn. They've got a genetic disease that's going to cause them problems in years, and they don't want to die. Point one, that starts off quite well. They've got huge resources at their hand, perhaps don't have the greatest of scruples, and they'll do whatever they can to survive. Again, that works for me, that's quite logical. I mean, it's not much of an exaggeration to say that he turns from friend of Peter Parker into deranged chemical imbibing monster in the space of a couple of days.
Yeah.
The motivation doesn't work, and therefore it's very difficult to care about the character and then care about what happens. It's not interesting. It's like they've just decided, oh, somebody flipped the monster switch.
Yeah. It's all about let's you and him fight.
Yeah.
For the sake of an ending. It's adequate. I didn't come out of it hating it, but I'm just looking back at it. 2 hours, 22 minutes, that's definitely too long.
Yeah.
But that said, it's competent in the way you come to expect from the sort of the Spider-Man franchise, I suppose. The Spider-Man original one was competent as well. It was somewhat better than this because it wasn't quite so weakly motivated. And I think even Jamie Foxx's character is... And he has slight motivation, but it's very slight.
Yes.
Against Spider-Man, and a lot of the set pieces, especially towards the end, just really aren't all that exciting. Doesn't look particularly interesting visually. It's fine. It's okay entertainment, but it's nothing more than that. It's a somewhat below-average tentpole movie, and certainly doesn't stand up to a lot of the rest of the comic book output over the summer. And we move on to A Million Ways to Die in the West, the Seth MacFarlane vehicle, written, directed and starring Seth MacFarlane as Seth MacFarlane in the West. That is basically the joke of it. He runs around a somewhat stereotypical Western town that is, and basically pointing out in snarky ways how bad the Wild West was and how dangerous it is, provoking at some point to enmity with various people such as Neil Patrick Harris and having a love interest with Charlize Theron. It's just not very interesting. It's one of these films where the comic concept is pretty obvious from the outset, and it just about manages to be funny enough to get away with the 90-odd minutes of your life that you'll spend in front of it. But, I mean, it's really not all that great. There's no real original jokes in here. There's some good moments, but it's nothing like as good as you'd have in something like Ted. It's just about fine. I think its main problem is that it's spending a little bit too much of its currency on trying to make you believe this love story between Seth MacFarlane and Charlize Theron, but the two of them just have no chemistry whatsoever together. There's lots of scenes that are effectively just dead air for minutes as they try and establish something of a relationship, which just doesn't wind up being particularly interesting or believable or, crucially, funny. As I say, it's probably just got enough funny bits in there to not make you feel like you've completely wasted your time and start demanding your money back for it, but it's certainly not something that I can recommend even to people who are fond of Seth MacFarlane's output. It's just not good enough. It's not one of his better days. Below average comedy, can't really say a lot more about it than that. Has its moments, but certainly nothing like enough of them to warrant your hard-earned cash.
Next we have Maleficent. I am no great fan of Disney and never have been, and Sleeping Beauty is certainly not amongst the few Disney films that I do like. However, the idea of creating a live-action prequel to Sleeping Beauty interested me, at least, and as it turns out, it's not too bad a film at all. Angelina Jolie plays the title character Maleficent, who is the evil fairy in Sleeping Beauty, if you don't remember. It tells of how she was born to be the ruler of the fairy kingdom, how she befriended a young boy of the human neighbouring human kingdom, and how she was betrayed and had her heart broken. It's quite an interesting concept, and it, for the most part, works. It retcons a bit the story in Sleeping Beauty, but it hits on a few of the bits that fans of the original film will recognise, as well as the story of Sleeping Beauty. And Angelina Jolie is very watchable throughout, very striking looking, but looks really rather like the character from the animation, as do so many of the other characters. It has some well-close CGI, very majestic backdrops, some nice moments of the young Maleficent sweeping on her new powered wings all over the kingdom and ruling with kindness and helping people. The way in which she's betrayed, though, is rather weak, and also isn't helped by the fact Charlotte Copley's accent is abysmal.
Yeah, I think it's now at the point where we need to talk about Charlotte Copley, because we need to stop casting him, basically.
Yes,
because
he's terrible.
It turns out he is dreadful in everything that's not District, whatever it was, and even then, he wasn't all that great in that. It was just because he had a slightly amusing accent that we let him away with it. But he's almost on the verge of ruining this film. Maybe not quite, I think, but he is very poor in it. And I watched the Old Boy remake, which is in many ways perfectly acceptable, with the exception of, surprisingly, Charlotte Copley, who's horrible in it. That he is now a menace, and we just need to stop. We need to say no. Yeah, that is really my only complaint about Maleficent, which otherwise was perfectly fine, above average, very entertaining, and quite an interesting way of spinning that story out. I thought it worked very well on a number of levels, but Charlotte Copley can get the fuck.
Yes, it's an interesting premise that worked. I liked it a great deal more than I liked the original animation. Angelina Jolie's great. Elle Fanning works pretty well as Aurora. The concepts are quite interesting. It certainly looks visually striking. The crow person, what would you call him, a lackey, generated out of a crow, perhaps overused a little, because his motivations aren't well explained, but he gets a lot of screen time. That's nitpicky, though. Yeah, it's a competent film. It's quite enjoyable. While, as I say, it retcons the original animation, it fits in nicely, and there are nice touches to any fans of it. It's just that, yeah, Charlotte Copley ruins it. Terrible acting, worse accent, not a particularly well-written character either, which doesn't help. The character doesn't need to do much other than be incredibly ambitious to do what he does, but I just don't think Charlotte Copley sells it well.
Yeah.
Yes, as you say, he's a menace. Vote no to Copley.
Sin City 2, A Dame to Kill For, which reunites Frank Miller and Robert Rodriguez in the slums of Basin City for another set of roughly similar noir-tinged violent affairs, another slice of small stories that sort of roughly kind of interweave together over the course of the hour and 40 minutes or so that it takes it. It features a largely returning cast with largely the same roles and motivations, and for the most part works about as well as Sin City did in the original incarnation. I think the only real issue with the film is that a lot of it is continuing stories and sort of character arcs from a film that is now approaching a decade old. And while I would normally be welcoming that kind of continuity, it doesn't really spend a lot of time reintroducing you to many of these characters. And as it turns out, their motivations and trials and tribulations aren't really so complex that it's much of an issue, but it just feels a bit strange that they've decided to just start up without really taking the time to catch up a lot of people who certainly wouldn't have been of legal age to watch the film, given the target audience of it. Usual comments, really. It's quite stylish, works pretty well. It's amazingly violent, but you kind of forgive it that, because it's all in this sort of strange black and white stylized thing, so it doesn't really count, apparently. It's perfectly fine. I think it's probably as well regarded as it needs to be. It's just fine, as the first film was just fine. As I say in my review on the website, I watched the film, nearly 10 years ago and haven't thought about it since. And up until now, I hadn't thought about Sin City 2 since, so if you like that sort of thing, it's the sort of thing you'll like, but it's not really stretching out to any new audiences, I don't think.
Fine is the word. If that's damning it with faint praise, that's probably spot on.
Yeah.
It's entertaining enough. There's a couple of casting changes in it, three in particular, one necessary, one that doesn't work, but again, I don't know the backstory to this, whether it was a forced change, and one that actually helps. Just quickly go over there, like Michael Clarke Duncan, sadly dead, so his role was taken over by Dennis Haysbert. Doesn't come close to having the same sort of physical presence as Michael Clarke Duncan, which is a bit of a letdown, but it's a fairly minor character. Daphne Aoki doesn't return as Dead Little Miho, and while she never had anything to say, Daphne Aoki is a particularly striking looking individual, and the woman that replaces her in this is an attractive woman, but similarly has nothing to say other than just stand there with a sword and doesn't work as well in a role that's purely visual.
Yeah.
And the third change is, instead of Clive Owen with his terrible, terrible accent, it's Josh Brolin. And given that the character undergoes plastic surgery anyway, that works pretty well. Josh Brolin's a better actor and isn't straddled with his terrible accent to do.
Yeah.
It's much the same as the first one, perhaps not quite so successful. It's very much a case of style over substance, but in this case, it's rather the point. It's not schlock horror, but it's schlock something. It's schlock seems to be the word that keeps going to head with this. It seems to fit it.
It's certainly a bit schlocky. Yeah.
Yes, it's quite entertaining. The only other issue I have with it is that having watched the original Sin City again just before I watched this, it feels to me like the timeline doesn't work. It sort of jumps forwards and backwards in time quite a bit. It's not entirely obvious what's happening when, and I think they've messed up. I'm very open to the possibility that I've messed up. It could be my fault, but it feels like the timeline doesn't quite add up compared to the first film, and given it's so heavily reliant on the first film, that feels like an error to me. But yeah, if you like the first one, you're almost certainly going to like this. Stylish, calorie-free, but entertaining enough. Next, yet another comic book film, and one that the world seems to have collectively lost its shit over, which is Guardians of the Galaxy. And I'm afraid to say, I don't quite get why. For those of you who've been living under a rock, this is based on one of Marvel's lesser properties, set not quite in the same universe as everything else is happening, I believe. There are a couple of references in here to other Marvel films, but it doesn't really seem to be happening in the same universe. It features a band who are thrown together through various circumstances that includes Rocket, a genetically modified being that just happens to look exactly like an Earth raccoon, Groot, a walking tree, Zoe Saldana as Gamora, a genetically modified assassin type thing. Assassin, you'd probably call that. a very, very literal minded alien called Drax, played by Dave Bautista. And the one human...
Can I correct you there? It is the animal Dave Bautista! Because he's a wrestler. Carry on.
Okay. Consider me suitably corrected. And completely not caring, but yeah, and the final person in the bunch, the one human, Peter Quill, played by Chris Bat, also known as Star-Lord. There we go. There's not a pretentious name at all. It's a fairly fun movie. There are some big action set pieces, as you'd expect from this sort of thing. Some are more successful than others. Also, you might expect that from this sort of thing. There's just nothing in here that's making it quite so special as everybody seemed to think it was, and I don't understand why people like it so much. There's some good interplay between the characters, and there's certainly some funny moments, and a couple of particularly notable set pieces, like the prison break, that are really quite funny. Bradley Cooper, Chris Pratt, and the one-note Vin Diesel really playing off each other quite well. It just lulls massively between, and is massively hampered by the fact that the villain is, well, both villains really, because there are two, is the most leaden, boring, uninteresting villain you can imagine. Hello, I want to take over the universe.
Is it Ronald Valiers?
Sharks in the jets, sharks in the jets. Hey, I want to take over the universe. Okay. Lee Pace plays Ronan, who actually would be more interesting if we were a member of Boyzone. wants to take over the universe and get the mystical MacGuffin from the Guardians of the Galaxy who happen to have it. He's just really leaden. The way he delivers his lines is so leaden, so uninteresting, and you just can't care or take him seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And again, you just largely hope he's... At least if he was Ronan Keating, he would break into song, and it would be a terrible song, but, you know, he would be doing something interesting. I feel like I'm doing it a disservice because I enjoyed it. It's not special.
I enjoyed it. It just doesn't have members of Boyzone in it.
Being mutilated.
That's Sorry. A very different target audience there.
The police have told me to stop that. no, it's a good film. It's enjoyable. The characters are quite entertaining, but they're just, as I say, there's so many lulls between things happening that I just don't see why people love it so much. worth seeing. If you like Marvel stuff, I would imagine you're going to enjoy it, even if you're not familiar with the characters, as I wasn't. But it's got dull villains, and the other big criticism I have of it is that it doesn't have any female characters.
Hmm.
There are women in it. There are no characters. It's a big problem. It's not by any means confined to Guardians of the Galaxy, but basically there are five women in Guardians of the Galaxy that have anything of note to do at any point. There's the woman who dies at the start, Star-Lord's mother. There we go.
Spoilers.
Okay, so we've got the woman on the deathbed. We have Glenn Close as the boring political woman with silly hair. She's a boring political woman. She has nothing to do. We have the woman who's a slave, and we have the blue woman and the green woman. These women don't have character traits. There's the green one and the blue one.
The Which is better?
There's only one way to find out. And it's a real problem. And Zoe Saldana has a thankless task in this, because all she has to do is be really, really gruff and green. And Karen Gillan has even less to do, because she's largely to be there and blue. You know, on screen while being blue. And the film, for all that the other characters are entertaining, needs a female character. Again, so many other films are missing it too, but it's really noticeable in this that all of the women in this can basically be characterised with one adjective, and two of them are the colour they are. So it's a real issue with this film, and it really, that alone would stop it being a great film, let alone all its other drawbacks. Again, though, no, I'll keep repeating myself, it's entertaining, you'll enjoy it, just don't think it's the best thing since sliced bread, as the box office figures would suggest it was. And one other thing too is that everybody seemed to be going apeshit over the soundtrack. Now, the soundtrack's not bad, but it's almost entirely incidental. It shares a couple of tracks with films that have used them much better, notably films by Quentin Tarantino. Now, when Quentin Tarantino uses songs in Reservoir Dogs, they're in scenes where the juxtaposition of the action and the music make them really memorable, really worthwhile. And in Guardians of the Galaxy, they're just the music that they happen to play at the time. And bar maybe one or two instances, they don't add anything to the scene. It's just the music they've chosen to play. It's got an 80s aesthetic to a lot of it. And so they play some 80s music because they've decided 80s music's a thing for it, rather than it adding anything to the scene. And again, people seem to be going mad for the soundtrack. It's not that great. I say it's not used that well, so there.
I've not seen this. What put me off it a little bit was people saying that, well, it's like the Marvel Universe, but it's, you know, giving itself license to go and be a bit zany and a bit wacky, and you know, most of the Marvel films are quite zany and wacky enough for me already, thanks. So I may catch up with it at some point, but I'm not going to stave my pan in to do it. Okay, as it turns out, that is not even close to the full extent of our podcast, but to give you a bit of respite, we're going to split this up into two, maybe three podcasts, which will be coming over the coming weeks. Plenty more to talk about, but I think 13 films is enough for you to get your teeth into for this podcast sitting. So, on behalf of Drew Avondale, I'm Scott Morris, and I'll catch you on the flip side. Peace out. Like a man, talk like a man. I'm Frankie Valli.
It's uncanny.